Welcome to Off the Deck. I'm your host, Steve Carrera, and each episode, I sit down with a member of the water polo community to speak with them about what helped make them successful in the world of water polo. If you enjoy the episode, give a 5-star review and share it with your friends. And if you want to support the program, you can go to offthedeckpodcast.com and donate to the program. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us on a new episode of Off the Deck. It's been a while. So I'm really, really happy to speak with John Abdu, who's been on the show before. John is now the associate athletic director at University of California, Irvine. Took that job a couple years ago after serving as the chief sports performance officer at USA Water Polo since 2017. So John, thanks for being here.
Yeah. No worries. Happy to be here and have this conversation about college sports and college water polo.
Absolutely. Well, first I want to say, congratulations on the USA men getting bronze. I know that people who are just, new to following international water polo, may not know all of the work that you did over the last, almost a decade, really, to try to get to this point, creating a lot of new programs, a lot of new opportunities for the men's and women's team. And, you deserve a lot of credit. And so I just wanted to first say thank you and congratulations, because you own that medal as well.
Wow. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Steve. And congrats to the guys, because they really, they performed, right?
Yeah.
The men and the coaching staff. So congrats to them and congrats to everybody. It's a good day to be an American when you think about this.
Definitely. Yeah. We've been waiting for this for a while. It's great. So, in the past, we've talked a lot about, just generally water polo and how we could make the sport better. Mm. But recently there's been some new rules with the NC2A that have come out really about, 3 weeks ago, where it was like published. And, you were the first person I thought of. I was like, okay, I got to call John. He's an athletic director. He's going to understand at least a little bit more, because you've probably been in meetings and stuff about this.
Yeah.
So the general overview for those who don't know is they've had three sort of major changes. And correct me if I'm wrong. So the first one would be roster sizes. There's going to be an increase and in some case decrease of roster sizes. And then the second one is scholarship changes, how many scholarships each sport can offer. And then the third is, sort of like the conversation where after we touch on those two points is like, how is that going to impact water polo? So just again, on the surface, from my understanding, water polo in particular now has a roster limit of 24 on the roster, and institutions have the leeway to give up to 24 scholarships for water polo on the men and the women. Just a couple other examples of roster sizes increasing. Football went from 85 to 105. Baseball increased to 34. Men's and women's basketball went from 13 to 15. And now you can basically scholarship every one of your allocated roster spots. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think in some cases those were decreases. Like the baseball example you gave was actually a decrease. They went from 40 to 34. And all of this isn't necessarily rules around roster sizes and scholarship. It's what it all is the end result of what is the $10 billion house settlement, right? That many people saw on ESPN, right? The lawsuit, against the NCAA, right? That's now being settled and still has yet to be officially approved. September 5th is the next kind of big date in this process where, the judges in the case will, either accept the parameters of the settlement or deny them. Most likely it seems like they're heading the direction that they will accept the parameters of the settlement. And if it is, then what you're talking about, some of the things you're talking about are the byproducts of what the settlement is.
Yeah. So water polo is like kind of unique. I'm sure there's other sports like this in the NCAA, but water polo is unique in the sense that in some ways it's an open division, right? Because like someone who is going to a Division II institution, I think UC San Diego would fall into that category.
No, they're D1 now. Yeah.
Okay.
They're D1
now. Yeah. Okay. Is there a D2?
Yeah. We got some D2s.
Okay.
Yeah,
like, so they can technically win the national championship.
Yeah, correct.
Okay. So, so with water polo, does that mean that every school in water polo is able to do this and they're restricted with their, 24 roster limit, or is this just like those big four, USC, UCLA, Cal, Stanford?
Yeah. No, that's a good question. So, and again, this hasn't happened just yet, right? So a lot, like we're still, we're anticipating, we're getting out in front, right? We're reading the news stories. And one of the titles I've been wearing for the last eight years or so is the executive director of the Association of Collegiate Water Polo Coaches, right? So our college coach association. So from kind of that role of leading the coaches association, coaches associations across sports tend to be more plugged into conversations like this. And so I'm also in a coalition of executive directors of college coach associations across sports. We call ourselves the ICAC. So there's swimming, volleyball, soccer.
Gotcha. Okay.
Basically all the Olympic sports. We come together, and we recently just even had a meeting on Monday with some folks from the NCAA just to be more educated about all this, you know? And so there's going to be an option where you opt in to the settlement or you can opt out of the settlement, right? And so we still don't know exactly like all the terms around that, but I can explain a little bit of it.
Yeah.
So D2s and D3s generally won't opt into this, right? They don't have to. The D1 settlement, the house settlement that we're talking about, all this money that is now having to be, given over, to be distributed back to athletes, right? All these, that was based on revenue share of the athletes. Every Division I institution in the country that's within the NCAA has had to participate in this settlement.
Okay.
Whether you had football, basketball, revenue, no revenue, you're in. So places like UC Irvine, UC San Diego, Santa Barbara, everybody, they're now going to be losing revenue. We are all losing revenue that we would normally be getting because we have to give that money back to the NCAA, despite not being a part of maybe the issue that was, caused a lawsuit in the first place. So there's going to be a loss of revenue. That's the first and foremost, that loss of revenue comes out. Now, then to kind of give the parameters around the settlement also then gives, this effect of roster limits, scholarships, we haven't mentioned, which is not part of the settlement, but the new realities of name, image, and likeness, which are having strong impacts across college athletic departments in the country. It's, there's a big impact of, where athletes are getting their money, their ability to use their name, image, and likeness. A lot of that is positive for the athlete, right?
Yeah.
We're taking an athlete approach, but it also has a negative impact on, could have another negative impact, and we've seen negative impacts on revenue and within departments and the ability to allocate resources to certain things if you are now thinking about how to allocate resources towards name, image, and likeness. And so the ability that after September 5th and as these things kind of come on, the day that this would become official would be next fall, right? It'd be the fall of 2025. If any of these, so these rules do not exist now. So let's be clear about that, right?
Yeah.
They don't exist now. It would be for the fall of 2025. And in that time, a lot of the details will come out. So Division I institutions will have the ability to opt in or opt out. For example, the Ivies have also kind of, appealed in this decision. Like Ivy League schools have, are likely going to be able to find a carve out away from this, right? Where they're in their own place. D2s and D3s will operate, essentially in the way that they've operated before, right? Because they're not necessarily part of the settlement and will likely won't opt in, and no need to opt into the situation.
And so if they don't opt in, then that means their roster limit is not, there is no roster limit. They can kind of do whatever they want.
Yeah, they'll do what they want to do, and they'll keep doing what they're doing. So, for example, the explanations of the settlement say that the roster limits for men's and women's water polo will be 24. But a lot of the Ivy League schools, a lot of East Coast schools, a lot of let's just call them D3 schools in general. A lot of the D3s or D2s, a lot of them operate with the roster limits on the men's side of 16, 18, 20, right? So 24 doesn't necessarily change. Anything,
gotcha.
Right. Like, those roster limits are generally bound by the constraints or the parameters of what Title IX analysis happening on that campus, okay. Right?
And so Princeton, for example, just throwing a name out there. Says, you know, you have a 20 person roster limit already. Mm-hmm. We're opting out. You're staying at 20. This doesn't give you four extra. Now, how does that impact the they're also opting out of the scholarship then as well, right? Because Ivies, from my understanding, don't give scholarships.
Correct. Yeah. So you this is an all in kind of situation. So you can't opt into some of the pieces of the settlement and opt into other parts. It's like this is a whole package, right? So these will be essentially be the new parameters around, like, if you opt in the settlement, this is the new way of being Division I. Right.
Gotcha.
And so this is very much a Division I focused, right, settlement. This is a division. The settlement is a lawsuit is about Division I, right? D2 and D3, you know, will operate in a different way. And then when we talk about, like, kind of the carve out of Ivies are technically Division I institutions, but we'll have a carve out to kind of operate in the way they want to operate based on their own appeal system as a conference that they're fighting for.
Are there any examples of conferences within water polo that you could think that have a majority of D2 schools? Yeah. What comp, like CWPA maybe, or
a lot of the D2s, this is a good actual opportunity to educate about what the conferences we have, right? So a lot of the conferences that we have in water polo are single sport conferences, meaning they're made just for water polo. And when we talk about conferences on the broader scale of NCAA and across the country, you're talking about multi-sport conferences like the formerly Pac-12 or ACC, SEC, Big Ten, right? Any of those things. Those are multi-sport conferences. So only recently, and this was a positive development in water polo, we really only have two multi-sport conferences that offer water polo, and that is the WCC, which is very new to us, right? Men's water polo, sponsoring men's water polo, and the WCC. Big West, which offers men's and women's water polo. And so that is a multi-sport conference in the Big West. And I guess there's technically like a 2.5 in the MPSF, which is technically a multi-sport conference, but it's a multi-sport conference that doesn't have football or basketball, right? It's kind of a catch-all for a lot of other sports, track and field, swimming, some other things that go in there. And so the conferences that you asked the question about, the D2. So a lot of our D2s have gravitated towards one of our single sport conferences, which is the Western Water Polo Association, the WWPA.
Okay.
So a lot of those schools, the D2s you're referring to, we only have a handful, right? But you're talking about, you know, Fresno Pacific,
Concordia,
Mercyhurst, Concordia, Gannon, Azusa Pacific.
Okay.
And so Biola now, right? New school over here. Those are your D2s that are operating in that world.
Yeah. Okay, so they're kind of mulling over what they're going to do, and most likely they're going to just operate as normal because they don't have to. It doesn't matter to them if they're D2.
Correct. And D2s really, like, if there was like a seesaw here, right, they will lean more, especially now in this new world order of what NCAA is like, they've already leaned a little bit more towards D3, and this will kind of help, I think, push them a little more towards leaning, operating more like a Division III school.
Okay.
And Division III and Division II, again, they will likely opt out of all of this. They don't need to opt in because this is an opt-in for Division I, right? So to be clear, they're not changing their status on their campuses, Division I. They're going to remain D2 campuses, D2 schools, D3 schools. And D3 has always kind of been that space in the SCIAC, you know, conference that we have here, CWPA on the East Coast, right?
And you've been – you know, one of the integral parts of like creating a D3 national championship so that they can kind of operate on their own, and which is great. I mean, I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
So let's kind of take it back to like specifically water polo.
Yeah.
I don't want to get to the negatives.
Yet, it's all right. Just talk reality.
I mean, so what's good about this for water polo? What's the positive?
Is there a positive? Let's take a deep breath. I'm with you. This is not like a negative thing, but we know each other in the way, and anybody who's listening has heard me talk. I speak directly and what is reality, right? So the reality is Olympic sports across the board are in trouble right now. I mean, this is not a good time for Olympic sports. It's shaky ground for Olympic sports at the collegiate level, in spite of the Paris Olympics just happening and the hype around it. So in water polo specifically for us, the if there is a silver lining to this, is this is not new territory for us, right? All of us who, like you and I, and all of us who have been coaching college water polo, or, you know, for 20, 30 years in the sport altogether here, we've never really been in a point in college water polo where we've all been like really secure, happy, and healthy with our sport. In fact, I can recall many conversations with athletic directors I worked for back in the day. They'd say, well, you're lucky we're not cutting your sport, John, right? So anytime I'd ask for more resources, the response was, well, we could just cut water polo, right? We don't have to have the sport, right? What that has done for our sport is we've become a resilient group, right? Like, we have become a group of coaches and clubs and a community that has found a way to navigate. We navigated Title IX, you know, okay, right? We navigated the 2000s, right? We navigated the financial crunch. We navigated COVID, frankly. We got through COVID and with a minimal loss of programs, right? And in fact, added a few programs along the way. So we actually have just as many men's, we have the second highest watermark of men's NCAA programs in our history of the sport at the college level, right? So we're in a really, we're in a relatively healthy space, and we've navigated this stuff before, right? And so now we're just going to have to navigate it again, right? And so we're going to have to think about creative ways to sustain our sport at the highest level. The D3 championship we talked about was a way to help sustain, retain, and grow collegiate programs at the Division III level. What can we do now on the Division I, Division II level, right, across the board to help and assist, sustain and retain our programs? And the advice I gave all our college coaches at our annual meeting, we meet annually on the day between JO sessions, right? So between boys JOs and girls JOs, we set that day. And so we are in that time frame. I talked about, what are you doing to really establish your program on campus? You know, can you be financially independent as you possibly can, right? Not relying on the university, not relying, because the funds are cutting, you know, the funds are going to be coming less, right? How can you become financially independent, or, you know, less reliant? Can you tie yourself to the campus in a way that makes your program, you know, stand out on campus? Are you integrated with the campus community, with the faculty, on committees? Are you serving the students of the campus in a way other than just saying, hey, everybody come to our water polo games?
Right? You actually describe a lot of the community college. What you're saying is what community college coaches have already been doing, which is we're sitting on committees, we're sitting on academic committees, we're having a voice within what the institution is actually doing academically, not just athletically. And I'm sorry to cut you off, I wanted to get a basic take on, you've said less funds, they're going to cut money. Mm-hmm. Explain to the audience why is the budget for water polo going to get most likely cut?
Yeah. So, because it won't just be water polo, right? So across the board, you know, non-revenue sports, Olympic sports, they're going to have to pay into this settlement, right? So this $10 billion house settlement that keeps showing up on the news and SportsCenter that you guys keep hearing about and reading on Yahoo Sports, right? The institutions are responsible for paying into that. And now that is scaled, right? It's scaled on your involvement. So schools that don't have, you know, high amounts of revenue, or, you know, big football, basketball, or mid majors, as we call them, right? We're not paying in as much to the settlement as those other schools are. However, when we're paying into that settlement, that means our budget could be down anywhere between 18% and 25%, right?
Jeez.
And so when you take 25% of a, let's call it $100,000 operating budget, that's $25,000 that somebody is probably losing in their water polo program, specifically as a result of maybe $500,000 to $1 million of revenue that their athletic department is no longer receiving, right? So the trickle down effect is athletic department's getting less money, so all the sports are getting less money across the board. And so if that helps make sense.
No, that makes sense. So I mean, basically, like, a school that has, you know, massive football team that's winning or like at the top of their conference, they're paying let's say $20 million a year.
Yeah.
Well, shoot. I mean, I can't give $50,000 to the water polo program as your operating budget because we don't have it anymore. So there becomes like a really tricky situation there, because every coach, whenever they cut a program, you know, we've been around long enough to see programs get cut. I mean, East Bay was just cut, less than a year ago. The first thing everybody wants to do, alumni and such, is they want to just say, we'll pay for it. You know, we will pay the operating budget. Do you feel like that's going to happen potentially more? Like you said earlier, like we have to be self-sufficient. Like, do you think athletic directors or institutions, I won't put it in athletic directors, but institutions are going to say, listen, I don't want to deal with people trying to raise the money. Let's just cut it. Or are they more like, let's just see what they can raise. And if they don't raise it, we'll cut it. You know, where are they, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think that'll vary across the board, right? On like the temperatures on each campus. You know, some campuses aren't interested in that, and some are. And where that's why my advice is, don't wait to see how they feel about it. Just make yourself as financially less reliant on the institution as possible, so that when the time comes, the conversation comes, like, no, we'll go raise the money now in a reactive way. Do it in a proactive way now, right? Try to find as many, how can you create endowments in your programs? How can you create endowments of your coaching positions, endowments of your scholarships, endowments of your travel budget, endowments of all these things? And then we have many institutions that have done a brilliant job of that. And there's a reason why we've survived, again, as a college sport when other Olympic sports are not so well. Like I look at rugby, and women's rugby had a great Olympic moment, right?
Yeah.
Winning a bronze medal, all over the news. I mean, this is not a varsity sport at the college level, right? Like, so for us, like water polo to be where it's at, it's because of the backs of so many people that have made sure that it stays in college places. So, you know, without naming too many names, right, we have many colleges who have done a great job of endowing their programs and making sure that money is coming in and there's less reliance there. And because the reality is too, on the revenue side, Steve, is that most college athletic departments are not making money.
Yeah.
So there's this misconception of like, oh, there's money out there. Well, how do college athletic departments make money? Well, the way college athletic departments make money is off of TV rights, right, from the conference. They make it off of ticket sales. They make it off of fundraising in a very third way. But the reality is those two things where you're getting, you know, TV right money from the conference and big, huge ticket sales and concessions and all those things that come with it only really happen at major, major football schools, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Cal is a great example. Cal has football. And it has a storied water polo program, three national championships in a row, right? That athletic department does not make money, right? That is an athletic department that has run in the red on a yearly basis, right? There's a reason why Cal and UCLA ran as quickly as they could to the Big Ten, right? These are athletic departments that by taking the check from the Big Ten, actually helped. That was a help to water polo, right? If had they stayed in the Pac-12 or had they continued to take the less revenue of the TV rights, then the Olympic sports at USC and UCLA were in danger. By going to the Big Ten and being part of that media rights package, there's a huge uptick in the revenue that those schools are getting. So I know that there's some negatives about travel across those. You'll hear those stories. The reality is that helped Olympic sports, right?
Yeah.
And so,
but that also, with that being said, when you move into a conference like the Big 12, you're or the ACC, you're now you can't lose 56-0.
Yeah.
So you now have to put more money into that football program. Like there's 105 scholarships now available. You're not going to even come close to competing if you're not offering 105 scholarships.
100%, right? And so that's the negative side of it. So yes, they went to the Big Ten. Maybe now they're not cutting Olympic sports, but they go to the Big Ten. And to your point, they got to be competitive in the Big Ten. So every penny, every resource, right, when it's being stratified into a prioritization strategy for the athletic department, is getting pushed towards the footballs, basketballs, right? The revenue, quote unquote, revenue sports to make sure they're competitive there. So to make sure that they're maximizing their opportunity in this conference, which means schools like UCLA and USC and Cal are not immune to some of the negative impacts of this settlement, right? Across the board, right?
Yeah.
Those are schools that, along with every other school, is going to have to continue to find a way to become financially independent and tether themselves to the campus in a different way. And like you mentioned, the community college model, which is why you're doing such a great job over there, and community colleges are such fun jobs and great jobs, because you really is more about, it's more than just about water polo and just about that game. You're really tied in. The other places that are like that are D3 schools, right? Like you talk to these D3 coaches, they're faculty members on campus.
Yeah.
Some of them are tenured professors while they're also coaching their water polo teams, while they serve on multiple committees, while they, you know, are really tied in. That's why water polo at the D3 level, community college, it's safe, right? Same thing. Yeah. Right, our conversation really in the risk or the negatives where we started this thing really lie in the D1 level, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
So how about, you know, because I started off with like sort of like what are the positives? So can, let's just say that no programs are dropped. Okay. Well, there's a ton of people. Everybody wants to play in the Big Four. I think most people want, you know, that's their dream when they start out. So are you going to see, do you feel like the trickle down or, and I'm kind of asking you to put on your USA Water Polo hat a little bit here because like you maybe trickle down doesn't always work. Are you going to see trickle down or are you going to see people quitting? In your opinion, like are people who don't go to USC or UCLA and they say, well, you know, we have an, you have an offer at, let's say Cal State Fullerton, up and coming program. Are they going to take that? Or do you think they're just like, I don't want to do it. I'm just going to stay at USC and, you know, and then on top of that, where does a transfer portal fit in with all of those sorts of things? So I don't know. Have you thought about that? Or have you guys talked about that?
A lot. Yeah. We've talked about a lot. And I think a lot of us, I think in this space for a very long time, and I give a lot of talks about recruiting and in water polo and the recruiting process and water polo. I use those talks when I give those opportunities to speak about that, to advocate for everybody to open their mind and look past just, you know, the quote unquote Big Four, right?
Yeah.
Of the Cal, Stanford, UCLA, right? USC. This has not been a problem. This is not a new problem, right? This is a new thing. This is an old thing that we've been dealing with for a long time where the athletes that, you know, we would coach in club, Steve, and we'd have growing up would rather be number 36 on the UCLA roster than being in the top 10 on the Fullerton, the Irvine, the Santa Barbara, the San Diego roster, or the Bucknell, Harvard, Princeton, right? Any of those things. And that's always been a challenge for us, right? It's always been a challenge for us. And so what I'm hoping this does on a cultural level, we've been talking about this a lot now for, you know, 20 years, can families and athletes start thinking more, they have a broader perspective around this. And where I think this does help in the terms of like your trickle down analogy is that those coaches at those four schools who will likely opt into, right, this settlement, right, and assuming it gets passed and approved, they are now going to operate in that 24 roster limit, right, which is lower than what they've operated at before, right? So generally, a lot of those schools could have 27, 30, 35, right? I mean, it depends. But I think in talking to those coaches over the years and talking to those programs over the years, I think they've already started to trend in that way, right? That they were kind of lowering their roster numbers. Everyone's kind of moving in this direction. So this actually helps encourage them to say, hey, well, now I got parameters around those 24.
Yeah.
So it'll be incumbent upon like all of the, you know, student athletes out there to start really thinking about what other options there are for them. And look, if you want to go to a USC and not play water polo, which is, I think, is what you're saying. So I'm going to stop playing. I'm going to go to USC and just, maybe I'm not one of the 24, but I'm going to go to a football school and I'm going to have fun. People make that choice all the time.
Yeah.
But I do think this does help create opportunities, not just in water polo, all sports, for athletes to go to more mid-major schools. Now, will it be, you know, the scholarship piece is another thing that's out there, right? Just because those schools will be able to offer up to 24 scholarships doesn't necessarily mean they're going to offer 24 scholarships, right?
Yeah.
The maximum scholarships right now on the men's side that a school can offer are 4.5. The maximum scholarships dollars on the women's side is 8. And most schools don't even have a budget for 4.5 or 8.
Yeah.
Overnight, they're not all of a sudden going to have a budget for 24 scholarships to start bringing people in, right? So that's something to consider as well.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was – you know, you and I have talked a little bit about the community college level and you know, how it's trended away, you know, like it's unfortunate, to be honest with you, not a lot of players, you know, at the community college level. And so my first initial thing was like, dang, man, we're in trouble. Like, I don't know if people were going to get anybody, because I didn't understand the scholarship part of it. I thought everybody's just going to get 24.
No.
But now after like talking to you and like sort of talking to some other coaches, it does seem like, you know, that trickle down should happen all the way down to the community college level, because maybe you're not done playing. Hey, I still love to play, but I want to go to Cal, If I don't get the coach to get me into Cal as part of the 24, I'm probably not going to get in, right? Because it's a very difficult acceptance rate. So I'll go to College of Marin that has a 50% acceptance rate to Cal Berkeley. I'll play water polo for 2 years because I still love it and I still want to do it.
Yeah.
And then when I transfer to Cal, I'll try to be on the team. If coach says no, I'll just go to Cal and I'll have a great time.
Yeah.
Like, that's like my hope that that happens, you know, like I really hope that happens. So, you know, I don't know. Have you talked to families that are just like trending towards that?
Yeah.
Or have you talked to families that are just like, we give up? Or have you, you know, have you heard any of those?
Yeah, no. I've heard the spectrum, but the situation you just described is actually one that I hope with you and every other community college coach out there, every other D3 college coach out there, every D2 college, every mid-major college coach out there is dreaming of, right? And I wouldn't say dreaming of, maybe that's not the right word, but really, you know, advocating for it, right? We're fighting for it. And it's not going to be a new advocacy. This is an advocacy that we've been fighting for a long time, right? And so I have talked to some families recently that are choosing the college. Like, there's another – nothing happens in a silo. So this $10 billion settlement, name, image, and likeness, roster limits, scholarships, all that's out there. This is all in juxtaposition to the rising cost of colleges, right? So now college costs more than it's ever cost before. We're also going where admissions is harder than it's ever been before at these things. So add those cultural and societal factors into this whole equation, and you live in California, and your tax dollars make community colleges free for you, right, to get free tuition at these at community colleges. You start putting all these pieces in together, the community college option looks much better than it was before.
Yeah.
When you take into consideration the fact that 7 of the 10 top most applied to colleges in the country are Cal State and UC schools, right? So this is across the country. Our schools here in California are the most applied to, right? 140,000 plus applications at UCLA at number one per year to yield a class, right? In the low thousands of that. So your ability to get into those schools has never been harder, right?
Yeah.
And so a lot of times when I give these college talks, I'll say like admissions is the new scholarship. Right, being able to get accepted into these universities is a big scholarship. So the reality is, the playing opportunity, in my mind, the playing opportunities are not necessarily going down at these schools now that their roster limits at 24. A lot of those athletes weren't getting playing time, weren't traveling, weren't making those rosters anyway. What's happening is the admission slots at those schools is going down, right? Because now those college coaches aren't going to have as many college admissions or like pathways or spots to use. Another factor to throw in there is the Varsity Blue scandal of several years ago, right? That also has put a hold on how many just college admission spots are being freely given, right, out through college athletics recruiting process. So we put in all these factors in, Steve, and you put that all into one. When a college coach tells you, hey, I can get you in and I can get you accepted, right, and you can come in and get an education and play varsity water polo, that's a huge gift. And so that's what we're advocating for, whether that's at the community college level, D3, D2, mid-major, D1, wherever. That's what families now have to start thinking about, right?
So let's talk rainbows and unicorns here. The ideal, you know, just like the dream.
Yeah.
You think that, okay, so like a school like UC Davis, UCI, I'll use UCI, your school, they're on the cusp of winning a national championship. They're pretty close to winning a national championship. They've got top caliber talent, but they might be missing one or two like pieces, depth, let's say. So in a perfect world, there's this guy who decided to go to, you know, one of the big four and doesn't work out for whatever reason. The coach says, hey man, I'm going to move on. I'm going to cut you, make spot for another person. That person enters a transfer portal. Now a school like UCI, UOP, you know, these people who are really UC Davis, who are really knocking on the door, are able to get that depth, boost their roster. And then a school like Davis, they say they pick up a guy like that. Now they have to make a cut if they've opted in.
Sure.
And then that person who loves to play, they might go somewhere else. Is that the ideal situation, and then you create this competitive equity that we've all wanted for so, so long. Is that how it's achieved?
It potentially, yeah. I don't know if I'd use the word ideal, right? Because I think all of us as college coaches and educators, we want to keep our athletes for 4 years and build relationships with them and coach them and, you know, get to know their families and watch them grow from freshman to senior year and all these things. But so
it happens. I mean, the butting heads, that's just part of college athletics, right?
I mean, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the transfer portal, you know, creates the mechanism for that, you know, for sure. Is that starting to happen? Sure. I mean, we started to see that before these roster limits, right? We started to see that before the roster limits started coming through. You'd see athletes go to, a quote unquote, I never like calling them Big Four, but quote unquote Big Four, what we, you know, idealize as the Big Four.
Yeah.
School. There's a lot of athletes that went there and transfer out. And Tar Prentice is a great example here at UCI, right? Started out at UCLA, ends up transferring to UCI, has a great experience, becomes our all-time leading scorer, and then becomes an Olympian here at the Paris Olympics, right?
Yeah.
And so that opportunity, you know, was potentially fueled by her decision to transfer, right? And so the transfer portal definitely puts that in. The other piece of that transfer portal that's out there is grad school, right? More and more grad schools and certificates that can be there. So you might go somewhere. You know, a lot of our athletes in water polo are very bright and academically driven students who finish in 3 years or take summer school and then have like graduate early or have an extra quarter. And then now they're going to grad school somewhere else. A great example, that's like a Dash McFarland, right? Going to grad school up at Stanford after, finishing up at UC Santa Barbara. And so I think those are really neat opportunities, right, to keep getting older players in that mix. And so, but what I guess the thing I'll say about all that, Stephen, the situation you're describing of transferring and trickling down and all this stuff is that families, I am starting to get the sense of the families I'm talking to are starting to get the idea that instead of going and transferring, can I just go to the right place immediately, right, and see the writing on the wall and knowing that, hey, I may not play over there and go. I spoke to a family this summer at one point that was really fired up about their son who was looking at all kinds of different colleges but has now chosen to go to University of Redlands. Because he knows if he goes to University of Redlands, he's going to get a lot of playing time, right? He's going to be on a team. He's going to be on a roster. He's going to be a great school. They got him accepted, right? And, you know, the idealization or maybe the romanticizing of what the college experience could be like somewhere else taken away and start thinking about what reality could look like.
Yeah. I mean, everybody says the same thing. It's like, wherever you go, you're going to have a great time. I mean, like college is like the best time of our lives, you know, like we make our way and like, you're going to make it a great experience for the most part. You have to be kind of a stick in the mud to like not enjoy college, you know? So as this like transition, like, because this is pretty abrupt, specifically for the class of 2025, you know?
Yeah.
Class of 2025. I do feel like they've had it rough. You know, they went through COVID going in eighth grade to ninth grade year. They missed out on, you know, a lot, as did others, you know? And, so do you think, okay, so coaches are saying, listen, come September 5th, I think was the date. We might get a roster limit of 24. All right. We're planning on that right now. So we're going to tell like some recruits, listen, I'm sorry. Like there's not going to be any room. Do you think that there's also a recruiting strategy where they're saying, let's see what happens in December in the transfer portal. So let's not give away our spots right now, because what if John Abdu becomes available in the transfer portal and we want to pick him up.
Yeah. I'm looking to make a comeback at any NAIA school that'll have a 45-year-old center, you know?
Yeah. The anchor, John Abdu.
Flying subs, I might help, I think, in these situations. Yeah. But I think that's the other. That's the other external factor here. So a lot of people will raise their hand and say, well, these roster limits are really killing the class of 2025. The reality is the transfer portal also hurt that, right? In the last few years of having the transfer portal hurt that as well. And now what you're saying is correct. You're going to have some coaches who are hanging out, waiting. What's the transfer portal look like? Let me wait till January. They may give away their first 2-3 spots to their top recruits right away, right? Their first 2-3-4. But if you're trying to get a recruiting class of 5-6-7, right, in each year – if not eight, then you're going to be more patient on the back end of that.
So it wouldn't make sense to give eight spots when you know that there might be a few available amazing pieces.
Right, right. Or we don't know everybody's story. Somebody decide, you find out somebody graduated early or wants to go to grad school or is connected to your grad system, wants to transfer so they can go to that specific grad program for what they want to study. All those things are out on the table. So what you're finding with the class of 2025 is they've hit the both ends at the same time. I agree. Yeah. They've had it a little tough because of this, right? Transfer portal stuff, now roster limits. And what I think the experience of many class of 2025 people is, either you were in that kind of top tier of recruits, mm-hmm. and this is settling for you pretty quickly right now, right? Like you're in the next month or so, you're kind of done with the recruiting process. You've committed, right? You're going.
Yeah.
If you're in that top tier, it's that the second tier that maybe usually would get more attention these days and is not getting as much attention as they used to get. They're the ones that are struggling right now, right?
Yeah,
and then there's
the
large bunch of people who you know generally are navigating the process, kind of hoping for. For the best without kind of a lot of that attention early on. And so that middle group, I understand, right, feels pinched right now.
Yeah.
And my advice would be to anybody kind of in that, I don't even call it middle, top middle, right? Upper middle, right?
Yeah.
Middle, whatever, right? It's a large, the middle class is large in general, right?
Yeah.
That is wherever you fall on the scale of that is to open your perspective to other colleges that may not be on your list, right? That original list of those first three, four schools that you're really fired up about that may be coming back to you saying like, hey, roster limits, transfer portal, things are getting tighter. I don't have a spot for you right now. Keep opening the list, right? Keep opening the options and find, and you may start finding some other schools that would love to have you, right?
Yeah.
And the sooner you do that, the better, because they're going to also just get who they can get as quickly as they can too. So the more you can communicate, the better.
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, just some players that I've coached. It's kind of a punch in the gut because it's like, we're, you know, I'm talking to this coach and that coach in this program. And mm-hmm. then all of a sudden it's like, you know, you put all your eggs in one basket or in a few, and then mm-hmm. that gets taken away and you're just like, okay, I don't even know where to go from here. You know, mm-hmm. like, I don't know. And so I guess the advice would be cast a wide net, you know, cast a wider net. And see where that goes. So,
and open your perspective to some of those other levels, like you meant the community college, the Division III, right? The other things that can go out there. But sorry, continue.
So the last point, and I maybe not the last point, but the last mm-hmm. point that I wanted to ask you was, and you touched mm-hmm. on it already with the budget stuff, is do you see a school in the next 2 to 5 years? Mm-hmm. on the men's side, increasing scholarships?
Before you answer that,
mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. I asked you this on the phone a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Can an institution fundraise for an athletic scholarship themselves? So if I was the coach at whatever university, the mm-hmm. school says, hey man, you got 4.5, that's all you get.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, okay, well, I got people who want to contribute to make another 4 scholarships. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they're ready to make a commitment for 4 years to do that. Okay. So I guess coupling those questions or scenarios together, what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. So yes and yes. So I think schools will increase their scholarship dollars. I think some will. It's not going to be overnight. You said it right. 2 to 5 years could be more. You know, that's a dramatic jump from a limit of 4.5 on the men's side to a limit of 24, right? So that money's just not going to appear. And again, money has to go to other places too. So a lot of places, like the student athlete, we haven't talked, there's so much to talk about here, Steve, right? I mean, the student athlete experience costs are a lot more now, right? So it's not just cost of living and tuition and housing. And, you know, now we're talking about like, are you getting fed, right? We're allowed to feed athletes at colleges. So instead of saying it's a scholarship dollar, right? Some schools have 3 hot meals a day available, right? For their athletes, which, you know, you do the math, right? That's a lot of money that you're saving by getting fed and snacks and protein shakes and right and all the experiential things that schools are now offering. Those cost money. So again, before a school says we're going to jump into scholarship dollars and invest in it and increasing our scholarship amount, are they increasing the student athlete experience side of it first, right?
Gotcha.
Are they creating opportunities for a name, image, and likeness? There may be budget money that's coming in from donors that says, hey, we're going to donate $10,000, but we want it to go directly to the athletes because now they can get it. And I want all the athletes at at this college to run a camp or a clinic for the weekend, right? And we'll help put it on, and you know, we'll pay those athletes for doing that. I own a business. I own a car dealership. I want 3 UCLA water polo players to come, you know, speak at this at the dealership on Saturday and promote.
Gotcha.
Now we could do that, and a donor might feel like I feel more attracted to giving my money. So this is the segue to the second part of the question, right? Donors choose where they want to influence, you know, the program. They're going to say, well, I want to pay for food. I want to pay for student athlete experience. I want to pay for, you know, medical costs on certain things, right? Now student institutions are required to take a Division I level, have to take care of medical bills for 2 years after a athlete leaves an institution if they on any injuries that they sustained while at that institution, right? So, I mean, the money isn't just the settlement. I mean, there's so much more budget money in college athletic departments that is now having to go to the student athlete experience and taking care of the student athletes. And again, on a macro level, that's great, right? We want student athletes to have these rights and to give them all those things. I wish we had it when we all played, right?
Yeah,
collegiately. We didn't have those things, right? I didn't even have I joked with people yesterday. When I got hurt playing in college, I went to a training room and there wasn't really a trainer there. We didn't have a strength coach, right? Like, we didn't have, snacks ready for us. Like, you know, sports psychologists, none of these things, right?
You had Newland at 6 a.m. in the weight room.
Yes.
And I was just thinking to myself, like, 2 years after, you know, they still cover your medical costs. Like, last day of college, I'm like, oh man, my shoulder's messed up. Wow. You know, so, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be someone who's first in this. Someone is going to say,
sure,
like, we're going to increase the scholarships and we're going to see. And whoever does that first is going to sort of set the bar to everyone else, because how do you compete if you're not at least on that same level? You know, like if, right? So, yeah, I mean, like, I guess, you know, the point of, I didn't realize that a donor could target money. And I don't know if that's a new thing, because I know like at a high school, for example, if you donate money, it's like, or even College of Marin, it's like, you can't specify really where that goes unless, you know, you could donate to the program for whatever operating costs, but like, not like very specific, you know, I want this to go towards, I don't think you can. Is that new, or is that just something? Yeah.
That's not necessarily new. It's kind of always been there, but it's definitely more overt now because of things like collectives, right? Where collective donors are coming together to build money for name, image, and likeness, for the purpose of name, image, likeness. It's always been available for capital projects, right? For example, if you want to build a new scoreboard, right? We're going to do, you know, improvements to the locker room, improvements to the pool. Donors have always, you know, been able to say, hey, we're going to choose this because it's on a capital campaign. And the scholarship to put money into an endowment that helps protect a, you know, coaching position or endowments for scholarships and things like that. That's why it's really becomes more about explaining what that word endowment means, right? That's money that's permanently given. And then when the interest that kicks off of it is given back to the program, because some institutions won't, and this goes, it can vary institution to institution. They don't necessarily want their donors to go into scholarships because, like you mentioned earlier, it might just be for 3 years. So we don't want to just say, hey, we got these scholarships for 3 years and then the money goes away, right? They want the money to be kind of into permanent fixings and things that can happen. And so it'll vary institution to institution, but there's now going to be, it's already started, a mad dash of college programs running back to their donors saying, hey, we need help, right?
Yeah.
And how do we buoy ourselves in this new climate? And what areas are we going to define as our competitive edge, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't do everything, right? So maybe, yeah, to your point, maybe those football Power Five schools might be able to try to, in the opt-in of the settlement, do as much as they possibly can, right, in that process. However, most schools will not be able to, right?
Yeah,
so they're going to like just kind of choose. We're going to make a great student athlete experience, right? We're going to do this. Yeah.
So the best, the biggest expense for a water polo program is the coach's salary, do you think?
Potentially.
Okay. You know, for the most part. The reason I ask is, well, just like, okay, scholarships, I guess that's true. But so there's like, you mentioned earlier, there's some like programs that have like the family scholarship, or I'm sorry, the family director of water polo, right? The Carrera family director of water polo.
Yeah.
So if you could give advice, would that be like one of the first things that, as like someone who runs a program, that you would be searching for? Like, let's get the coaching position endowed so that that's off the table. What is that going to be an important step to this process?
Yeah.
Do you think?
I think so. I think endowments are huge, right? So a great example, and I'll use a personal one first, you know, but a shout out to Dan Richards over at Bucknell University, right? In my time when I was coaching men's women's water polo at Bucknell University, and this endowment, he created his family endowment there, and that continues to grow, and people continue to donate into that endowment. And the reason that, you know, one of the main reasons that he and his wife and family were so motivated to put the endowment in was to secure that men's women's water polo would stay at Bucknell for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And so without the fear of getting cut, right? And so that endowment exists, and the money that gets kicked off helps with a variety of things, operating budget, right? You know, foreign trips in the summer, right? Anything that kind of keeps the program buoyed. So my point of giving that example is that it doesn't necessarily have to be the, you know, like a shout out to Greg Penner, right? Who endowed a Stanford coaching position there, right? To have the Penner family, you know, coaching position that's there. It could be the family endowed coaching position. It could be we're taking care of operating budgets. But when that endowments exist, that money's not going anywhere. Right?
That was my next question is can the institution take that money? They can't, obviously. No, that money is set for that program, or?
Yeah, exactly. And so as long as it's negotiated right, and the, you know, like, I don't ever want to speak in absolutes, right?
Yeah,
but you're putting the best legal writing in there possible, so you don't lose it. And I've talked to people who use language in their endowment writing that, you know, includes you know, the maintenance of the program, to make sure that if there ever were to, the thought of ever were being cut, that, you know, because the endowment, it's got to stay, right? So there's some stipulations that go in there. And so, you know, an endowment of $1 million is going to kick off $50,000 to $60,000 a year, right? You get $1 million endowment, you get $50,000 a year. That doesn't seem like a lot, but that's an assistant coaching salary. That could be your travel budget for the year. But $1 million is a lot of money, right? So how do you start collecting all that in to get it going? So we do need major donors, you know, to step up across the board and within their alma maters. And again, I think the inspiring part about this, as I mentioned already, many schools have done this already across the country, have built very strong endowments for themselves, which is why we're still alive and healthy today. That people are more passionate about their alma maters and their college experiences than they are of anything else. Right? This is a chance to rally that group and really think about what your experience was like when you played college water polo, if you played college water polo, and how you can give back to your alma mater.
Giving those opportunities. Well, I know you're pressed for time. We've got a couple more minutes. I just wanted to ask you sort of last thing is look into your, you have a crystal ball, right? Somewhere.
Look into your
crystal ball and tell us what you think the landscape of water polo is going to be in about 5 years. And specifically scholarship levels, where you think, if you can, and also competitive equity, you know, is somebody winning a national championship that, you know, has been relatively close before? You know, I'm thinking like a Davis, San Diego, you know, they've been pretty close. LMU has been very close in the past. And the last part of that is, do you see more programs in water polo 5 years from now, or are we seeing less, or is it the same?
Yeah. I'll try to answer as much of that as I can. Right.
And I understand you are an athletic director. There are certain things that you probably don't want to say or can't say or whatever, because you're at an institution that's going through this right now. So like, if you have to tiptoe around some advice, I totally understand.
Yeah. I don't think there's much to tiptoe around. I think everything's on the table at this point. Right. I mean, this is a national, scene that's happening right now, right? This is all happening publicly, you know? So, look, I think I'll start with, competitive equity. I wouldn't say that I have a lot of hope that competitive equity, I mean, I think there's opportunities for players for very, very talented players who would normally play at a Power Four school, to play at a mid-major. I think that those opportunities are going to be there. There's no doubt. However, the first people to the, you know, to be able to add more scholarships, to add more student athlete experience funds, are going to be those Power Five schools that have opted into major media right deals across their department, right? And so water polo gets to be a beneficiary of that. So I do think from a competitive equity standpoint, it'll likely remain status quo, right, for a while, where you're looking for big major upsets, because the ability to provide for those athletes the way that those schools already do isn't going to get any worse. It's only going to get better how they're able to provide for those athletes. They'll be providing for less athletes, but they'll still be providing very well for those top athletes, right? Yeah. And so they'll still be really, really competitive. I do think from a scholarship standpoint, I think you're going to see a variety of things, right? You're going to see a variety of things happen. Some schools will have more scholarships. Some schools will keep their scholarships. Some schools may ditch scholarships and just say, we have a great experience that we're going to offer, right, for our athletes. The scholarship dollars are now going to move towards making sure you can go make NIL money and go do other things and create opportunities for you. So I think the scholarships are going to be across the board. But I'll die on a hill about admissions as the new scholarship, right? Yeah. I think as families, young families like ours, right, a lot of people in middle age who are working up have hopefully been planning for college financially and understand where the opportunities are financially in college, where the admissions is going to mean much more than the scholarship already does. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so taking advantage of community college opportunities, taking advantage of D3 need-based aid, you know, the wonderful financial aid systems that our Ivy League systems have. These are all outside of scholarship merit water polo based aid. So I think scholarships will be all over the place. I think competitive equity remains status quo. And I do think if we can forge a creative path for ourselves, there is an opportunity for us not to lose too many programs. And I think there's an opportunity for us to grow. The growth is going to happen, though, on the D2 and D3 level. It's going to happen at the D3 level, right? Again, we've talked about this in podcasts in the past, right? The pathway towards that. And if you're interested, you can go back and listen to those. So I won't go through it now. But the reality is, those are the schools that need enrollment. Those are the schools that need the activities for their athletes. Those are the schools that the professors and the coaches are all tethered together, and they're great communities that can build towards that. And so we will grow. I believe we will continue to grow at the D3 level moving forward, potentially at the D2 level. Our D1 schools, the goal now is to retain the program, right? Yeah. To make sure that it doesn't go away at that point. So
you don't see a scenario where like University of Oregon, you know, they're like, man, we got a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You know, let's add this because we want to add that.
That's not anymore. Not anymore. Yeah. Listen, 10 years ago when we were talking about this, and I was running around. I went to many Power Five schools and banged on the door of the AD or got them on conference calls or, you know, visited with them in person. And back then it was a long shot. But we were throwing Hail Marys and hoping for the best and, you know, trying to get a Arizona State to add a men's program along with their women's program, right? Like, you know, kind of there's it makes sense. You have coaches already, you have infrastructure, right? You have a pool.
Yeah.
You know, this makes all kinds of sense. And the price tag back then was enormous, but it was still a possibility. Fast forward 12, 13 years later to where we are today and where we're sitting having this conversation. That was a possibility. It's a possibility now. And the reason I think it's not a possibility is because any dollar that is being generated in revenue by the university is going to be siphoned by the revenue sports immediately, right? Yeah, and it has to go into that, into settlement money. It's going to have to go into scholarship money. Yeah. Like you mentioned, 105 football scholarships, man. I mean, that's a lot
of money.
We were all advocating. It was at 80 something before, right?
85
before. And many of us who were in the Olympic sports space were like, well, hey, what if you guys just went down to like 65? Right.
Yeah.
You still be competitive at 65 football scholarships. So those other 20 scholarship dollars, that money can come back and help Olympic sports. That's like now you're talking about more money on football scholarships, more money on student athlete experience, food, you know, medical expenses, NIL, all those things. So the reality for those Power Four schools is they're going to have to do everything they can to remain competitive in their revenue sports. And the Olympic sports are going to suffer. And Ohio State came out and said something earlier today. I was reading an article, right, where you know, they're already kind of publicly saying that, you know, Olympic sports are going to suffer because of this. So Olympic sports are going to have to find all of Olympic sports are going to have to find their own way to survive financially, their own way to tether themselves, and also maybe potentially get creative on what their seasons and what their calendar competitive year looks like. Another interesting thing I'll drop in the kind of future casting, right, of water polo, right, is that there are now less rules around playing club water polo in the off season than there were before. Right.
Yeah.
So now you can play, as long as you're not in a championship segment of your season, you can play club. And so what does that mean for us as a country in terms of creating a system, right? Does it start shrinking the college season smaller? Does it? So we have to think about this as water polo community members from a macro, you know, level of how we can maintain what we have now and continue to grow at the grassroots level.
I mean, you're going to see National League, you know, times 10, you know, like if all these colleges can play kind of unrestricted, you're going to see water polo year round potentially, because it's also another source of revenue for their program. You know, if they're paying dues or they're paying whatever, it can go into their program, I would assume, to boost it. So yeah, that's very interesting. I know that you, are still navigating through all of this with your student athletes and your coaching staff. And you've done a really good job of explaining it. And I feel like I have a better grasp of it. Hopefully the people who are listening to this have the same understanding. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time to do this, and always appreciate talking to you. I always feel like we have a good chat when you're on this thing.
Yeah. Hey, my pleasure. I hope it helped. And if those of you guys who are, navigating those families and athletes out there, high school athletes who are navigating the recruiting process, you can find a lot of the college talks I give online, right? A lot of people have recorded them. Happy to share, you know, have that spread around just about the recruiting process. Hopefully this situation, this podcast helps as well. And then I think I want to shout out the ACWPC, the Association of Collegiate Water Polo Coaches, right? And our board, our executive board, and all the people who work through that organization. My feeling is that organization, as we continue to advocate for water polo nationally, is going to continue to be vital in this process. So anything everybody can do to help support that, the ACWPC will go. Yeah.
What can they do? What should they just go to the website, you know, like send a dollar, you know, send a few bucks, you know?
Yeah. Well, we're hoping to have our 501(c) status done soon so that we can start taking donations. You know, another place to advocate is with USA Water Polo, with a new leadership that'll be there as well, right? USA Water Polo, in my time and Greg Meskel's time, they're really upped the amount of commitment to collegiate water polo through paying for the Division III National Championship, right? Sponsoring the Division III National Championship, sponsoring. But maybe people listening right now don't know ESPN is not the one paying for those broadcasts that are out there. That's USA Water Polo funds that are paying for the National Championship, men's and women's National Championship games to be funded, to be out there. You know, they get, the U.S. Air Reporter gives us the space to have our annual, the ACWPC annual meeting at JO's and things like that. So, you know, shout out to USA Water Polo for that support, right? So, but moving forward, you know, if people want to get involved, they want to help, but the advocacy is for college water polo to survive, because we all know that it's the backbone of the ecosystem of our sport in this country.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, offline, I'll give you the name of water polo person that set up my 501(c).
Oh,
well, I'll just say here, Freddie Sicard, referee. He's great. I mean, he is amazing. So if you're looking for somebody, I shout him out. He helps me out a lot. So he's a great guy.
No, all good. Yeah, no, Freddie's great, and appreciate that. Hopefully, we should be up and running here in the next couple of weeks. So we're at the finish line to do that. But the way that you can, the reality is, yes, we will start fundraising for the ACWPC to start, you know, making sure that we can continue our advocacy for college water polo across the board. And we could talk about that some other time, all the things that the ACWPC does and what it can do. But the best way to support the ACWPC right now is go support your alma mater, go support your college, right? Go support your institution, because I guarantee when you call that institution, your coach or whoever's leading and the ADs over there, they have some ideas for you to help keep water polo at the institutions that you all care about.
Yeah. Well, man, thank you a lot for this. We'll talk soon, and I'm sure things will evolve after September 5th. We'll get a better idea. So thanks again.
Yeah. We'll stay in touch. Yeah. Appreciate it.
For sure.
All right. Take care.